Hello, welcome to episode 184 of the Chattering Classes. I thought I would do something a little different mid-year. At the end of the last couple of years, I've done basically a year in review of movies, books, and music. And I thought, why would I wait till the end of the year when I could do it halfway through? So, 'cause it's pretty much halfway through the year, isn't it? Fancy that. Oh my goodness. Where does the time get, etc. So yeah, that's what we're going to do. If we're lucky, I'm going to get my lovely wife Justine to join me at the end of the episode to discuss a movie we watched recently that is gross and horrifying, and if you're squeamish, I would get out of there before we get to it. It'll be full of spoilers too, so if you don't like spoilers. But really, I don't know how many people are going to want to watch it, even if I tell you what it's about. But anyway, that's coming up later. Let's play some music.
Once you see my black mascara run from you into my mama's hands, you selfish man, you
Ray from last year, I think. Black Mascara. Like it. Good song. All right. What shall we start with? Let's just go through some movies, shall we? What I've watched this year. And I say, well, we'll keep it fairly brief and then I'll get out of here. I've watched quite a bit of movies from all over the map, really. That's the joy of being accessed or having access to all these different movies, is you get to just sort of jump around the map. Not necessarily movies all from this year, but movies I have watched this year, movies I'd never heard of before, movies I had heard of that I thought I'd, you know, eventually check out. And so, like, I watched Fat City. Good name for a movie, not what I was expecting. It's from 1972. It's a John Huston film. A movie which, right, the description of it, which is two men working as professional boxers, come to blows when their careers each begin to take opposite momentum. That's not what happens in the movie. I hate it when they do that. Has that been the byline of this movie since 1972? Because that's not what happens at all. But anyway, it is a movie from a time when people who looked normal and not well could star in movies. Like, Stacy Keach is not a... He does not have a film star's face. There is something about him that is really arresting and believable, but he is not happy at any stage in this movie. The joy of it is, too, is that you've got two people, like Jeff Bridges, very young Jeff Bridges, so fresh in the face, and Stacy Keach are boxers, and at no point do you look at them and think they should be doing boxing. They don't really look like athletes. Jeff Bridges has sort of like this spry, wiry, young, you know, rhythm to him. But Stacy Keach just looks like a man who drinks a few cans of beer before breakfast and goes about his day down on the docks, on a trawler or something. He just looks like a lived-in, you know, very lived-in face. And he also surrounds himself by people at the pub. You know, anytime someone goes to a bar at 10 in the morning and the usual's there, that's the other rest of the cast. So the movie isn't about two men, you know, with different points in their careers. It's really about two men, one who's sort of past it, sees potential in the younger man and sort of invests a bit of time, not much time, to try and help him out. And then you just sort of see their paths cross here and there, and go up and down, I guess. And Jeff Bridges sort of, as young people want to do, just makes decisions based on the moment and without really any regret. So I don't know. I don't like it when they describe movies the way they are. But anyway, I found it really interesting. It's entertaining. It's from 1972, because it's not a happy film. It's grim and it's sort of dank and it's sort of, I don't know, feels like a beer-stained bar mat at closing time that has to be wrung out. That's kind of what the characters are like in Fat City. And then, I mean, why don't I go back? I'll go back because I joined Letterboxd this year. So my problem was that I added like as many movies as I could think of on one day at the start of the year. But now I can't find out what movies I watched around that time or what movies I'd already seen and rewatched anyway. But anyway, I've got a couple. Let's go through it in time, I guess. So I watched a couple of older movies. I watched Brief Encounter from 1945, which is this beautiful, strange movie, very British. It's the end of the war. It's about a woman who meets a young, handsome doctor, and they are both married, and it's a brief encounter. And the whole movie is sort of fraught, and the will they, won't they of it all, of them two obviously having a connection, and then going home. You see her anyway, go home to her children and her husband. You know, a lot of times in these kinds of movies, they go home and the people at home don't understand them, or the people at home are horrible to them, or the people at home are, you know, treat them terribly and they're put upon. But in this movie, she goes home and her husband's kind of, you know, sort of, I guess, into the routine of the mundanity of married life. But not even in a horrible way, like in a sort of charming way. Like, let's sit down together. I'm going to do the crossword. You're going to lie there. You're very smart, my wife. I'm going to ask you every now and then to help me out, and you'll be able to help me out, and we'll have a jolly time and go to bed. And someone will take care of the children upstairs and blah, blah, blah. So it's not really about like, oh, this poor woman has to get away from her husband. It's what happens when you're an adult and kind of happily married and you connect with someone. What do you do? How do you act on that? And I don't know. It just builds all this sort of suspense out of nothing. That's probably the key to it, right? It's Noel Coward. And a lot of it is just building this tension and suspense out of little moments and being with someone you're not meant to be with, and then running into people you're knowing, the covering yourself with a lie and how big that lie gets. And it has a tremendous beginning and a tremendous ending. And I'll leave it at that. I also saw Marty, from 1955. Ernest Borgnine won an Oscar playing Marty. He's just this schlep, this sort of put-upon man whose mother, he lives with his mother, and his mother's trying to get him to get married, and he's just, his mates are talking about all the women they sleep with, and he doesn't meet anyone. And then he does maybe meet someone, but then he come on too strong, and he's a bit awkward, and he's just, I don't know. Again, a very lived-in character. It's the reason he won an Oscar, and the writing on it's pretty fantastic, because it's the same thing. It's these written, well-observed characters rather than, oh, I hope he does well. You're kind of like, oh, Marty, like, would I hang out with you? Probably not. I don't know. But you just see him struggle to sort of be himself and be in his own skin. Who can't relate to that? That's Marty. That's Ernest Borgnine. We love a bit of Borgnine, don't we? I watched two movies pretty close together from 1966. And for anyone listening who went to school with me, I mean, we, or even uni doing drama, we would have been infuriating if we saw either Persona or this movie Daisies. Now, Persona is an Ingmar Bergman movie, like I said, from 1966. And it's about, shot in black and white, it's mysterious, it's got cutaways, it's got filters over top of filters, and it's a really interesting movie. I will actually read you the byline of Persona from 1966. I think I called it Inscrutable on Letterboxd, but this doesn't spoil anything, but you'll get a sense of, like, if I watched this when I was in year 11 or year 12, I would have been like, oh, this is the greatest movie ever. A young nurse put in charge of Elizabeth, an actress who is seemingly healthy in all respects but will not talk. As they spend time together, Alma speaks to Elizabeth constantly but never receives any answer. But Alma eventually confesses her secrets to a seemingly sympathetic Elizabeth and finds her own personality is being submerged into Elizabeth's persona. So it's this really, again, strange art film which has been stolen so many times. It is every pretentious art film that you've ever seen since done by students who have clearly watched some Ingmar Bergman and gone, oh, that's how you do it. You just put everything in black and white and put mirrors, lots of mirrors. That's what I'll do. Put some lace, a bit of lace and mirrors and wind and the sand and it will hint at sexuality, but we might talk about it, but we won't actually show it and all of these things in 1966. And if you thought that was catnip for the drama students, then you need to see this movie, Daisies. It's Czechoslovakian from 1966, and it is described, let me get it here, as a Czechoslovakian, madcap, feminist, absurdist farce. Fantastic. But if I was studying it again, absurdism, I think we might have done a unit where we did absurdism, or we got to choose a style and we did absurdism, of course. Ugh, teenagers doing absurdism means let's just piss fart around and just non sequiturs and that's fine. Which I guess this movie is, right? The movie is kind of dadaist and absurdist. But the stylistic choices, the writing, cross-cutting, symbolism, and characters, I would have stolen everything. Very influential movie. I'm sure a lot of people who make movies watch this and took some stuff from it. I'm sure people who made music videos definitely borrowed heavily from Daisies. It's kind of making social commentary on when you are young and pretty, you can lead a better life by wooing older rich men who will pay for your dinners and basically feed them. That's what they're interested in, is being fed because they're so poor. And also they will show you a better life and then you can ditch them and pick someone else. So it's probably 1966. I immediately banned when it came out. But they actually say, like, the world is terrible. So why not just have fun and be weird and do strange things and mess with people? And you're like, that's very, you know, young people, invisible theatre, fun and games that I would have definitely, again, if I saw it in high school, why didn't my drama teacher go, hey, everyone, you should watch this movie? We would have been like, wow, we are so intellectual watching a movie with no real plot and all these stylistic choices. But that's Daisies from 1966. Weird. Good movie, though. Okay. So a movie that I watched recently, which I'd heard of for many years, but a movie that is probably up there with, like, my favourite of the year, certainly one I've thought about a lot, which is from 1984, and it's Wim Wenders, and it's Paris, Texas. I guess, again, it's fairly, keeps you at arm's length. It does not want you to really understand exactly what's happening. It's kind of saying, that's not your place. It's not our place to understand the way everyone's thinking. But it kind of just starts with this guy who's wandering around in the desert, who's not talking, who doesn't know who he is, until they find some ID on him and contact his brother, and his brother has to try and get his family back, because years earlier he walked out of his family. It is a movie where I did not know what was going to happen next. Isn't that what you want from a movie? Like, I didn't know. I would recommend it to everyone, but I would say some people are going to watch it and be bored. And I would say, yeah, I get that, because it's fairly slow-paced. And anytime there's a sort of lack of dialogue, especially at the start of the movie, there's a lot of silence. It can be kind of dull. I don't know if you ever saw the movie Jerry. Gus Van Sant did it, and it was Matt Damon and Casey Affleck. That was basically them walking around. They got lost in the I don't know where. They went on a bushwalk or something, and they got lost. And it just sort of, you would literally have these unbroken shots for like 8 minutes of two people walking, and the sound of their shoes and them needing a drink and not talking. And this movie is more interesting than that, that's for sure. But this one, it changes setting, it changes scenery, it changes tone a fair bit. It changes sort of the direction a lot. What you think, if I stopped it after 30 minutes and said, you know, and said, what is this movie about? And then you stopped it after an hour and you say, what is this movie about, or what's going to happen? I think it would change, one of those movies that changes every sort of half hour. It's just really different. It's a bit, I guess it's a little bit like David Lynch, but not. I find David Lynch like deliberately confusing, or maybe I'm just confused, but deliberately like surreal and alienating. This one sort of just, it's probably starts off that way and slowly reveals itself. Maybe that's a better way to put it. So yeah, if you like that kind of stuff, it's, you know, over 2 hours and it's Paris, Texas, and it's a movie that kept coming up. I think I kept hearing people talking about it, and that's usually what drives me to watch older movies, is all of a sudden I'm like, huh, I have heard of this, I haven't seen it, I'm going to watch it. Yeah, that's Paris, Texas. I watched a fairly new movie called Passages. Where is Passages from? It's sort of set in Paris, but it's a German film. German Paris, so there's different languages being spoken in it. And it's an okay movie, but really it was a really good example of perspective in a movie as well. Like centers around this character Thomas, and Thomas is just a tool. I think that's how I took him anyway. I just didn't like Thomas at all. He was fairly selfish and impulsive and would make these decisions and then just basically, oh, I'm going to commit to this person. It's all about his love life, basically, but he commits to people and then he's like, no, actually, I've changed my mind. Oh, no. And so they made these big, sweeping, grand gestures and swept up in love, and then, no, I don't actually want to do that. And, oh, well, how about we move in together? And, well, no, actually, I've changed my mind. There's a lot of that in this character. So I think I wrote at the time that, like, I liked the movie, but I didn't like the character. But again, this is one of those cases where, have you been like this guy where you sort of play with other people, or if you know someone likes you or someone loves you, that you take advantage of that and you're like, oh, okay, I like that someone else. So you just, there's a lot of that. Oh, someone, oh, you know, I'll go out with you because you're there or you're available, but, you know, I'll keep my eye. Oh, that person's single. All right, well, see you later. And a lot of that stuff, you don't see, or those characters are redeemed. But there's not much redemption in the movie. It's kind of like towards the end of it, he's still relying on other people to help him, I guess, or to accept him back. There's a lot of that, just him, you know, ruining people and then hoping that they take him back later on down the line. I saw Civil War, which I enjoyed. It's, again, an interesting movie in the way it's sort of, it's not really about a civil war. I think a lot of people went to see Civil War and hoped that it would be, oh, let's see what's wrong with America and have commentary on that. But it's actually a commentary on how war is presented by the photojournalists and what we do and iconography and how we receive images and what we do with images and how an image represents an entire war. Like, it's no surprise that, you know, like that we're dealing with Alex Garland, who's, I think, I don't know if both his parents were or people in his family were photojournalists. So it's no surprise that that's really what the movie's about. And it's more about how they present the war to the rest of the world versus, like, you know, let's make a movie about what's wrong with America and how it can be fixed. I also, when I was watching it, it just kept reminding me of zombie movies. And I don't know if zombie movies are, like, allegorical for Civil War or for, like, war movies, like people, you know, rising up against each other or fighting each other or human against human. But I don't know. It just struck me as I just kept thinking, maybe it's just the way it's shot, like all movies sort of in the same style of post-apocalyptic in America. There's a lot of movies like that that have zombies in it. I don't know. But that was another one that I saw, which I enjoyed. I also watched Babylon. Oh, my God. So Babylon, I don't know how much it costs, $180 million to make. It's Damien Chazelle. I always like Damien Chazelle movies. I liked Whiplash. I didn't mind La La Land. I really, really liked First Man, the movie he made about Neil Armstrong. I nearly said Neil Diamond then. That would have been weird. About Neil Armstrong, where he shows him as, like, this, again, this man who's hard to know. And that's what Neil Armstrong was like, but it was sort of what isolation, what you have to go through to land on the moon. I thought that movie was not marketed well, or maybe just people don't want to see it. It's like Apollo 13, but not as exciting, or whatever. We can see the moon landing, but I always like his movie, so I was looking forward, and I'd heard about it. It's, you know, Babylon's 3 hours long, and I've heard it's excessive. And but again, some of the scenes are incredible, and some of the shots they did are just so epic. Like, they're literally epic and intentionally epic to reflect, like, the golden age, like these 1920s, 1930s, huge, excessive movies with thousands of extras. Sort of, let's recreate that. But I just, like, kept thinking, like, I've seen this movie. Like, it's a movie for people who like movies, but I've seen Singing in the Rain. Like, and a lot of it is about that. Like, people film going from silent films to talkies. But yeah, I've seen that. That was in Singing in the Rain. This is it funnier? No. Is it grosser? Yes, it's sweatier and poopier and cokier. There's plenty more coke and plenty more nudity than Singing in the Rain, but it's pretty much the same sort of story of rising stars and falling stars and how Hollywood treats young women and replaces them and what happens when those women get replaced as well. And then kind of, yeah, just says, oh, movies are good, everyone. Just remember that. Movies are pretty good. And, yeah, enjoyed that. I enjoyed watching Dream Scenario with Nicolas Cage. Again, really cool concept, sort of, I don't know. When you've got, like, high-concept movies, as soon as they start to try and make a point about the society we're living in, they kind of just fade away. But Dream Scenario is pretty funny. If you find it and watch it, it's just really absurd. Nicolas Cage just keeps being in other people's dreams. I really liked how him being in other people's dreams, I guess if that happened to you and you all of a sudden popped in, like, we're talking like everyone in the world just keeps dreaming about this one man, would that be like being a celebrity? Would you take it as a compliment? What happens when it turns on you? So I think it's more about, like, it's, again, allegorical about social media and fame culture of, like, everyone knows who you are, great, and then things might start to turn. But I don't know, Nicolas Cage playing with his ego, always entertaining. That's Dream Scenario. Anyway, that's enough about movies. I'm going to watch lots more movies, I'm sure, in the coming months, and I'll check in now. So let's hear another song that I like.
Couldn't always come to mind when your dad got angry. So I'd play new job as down the phone for you to hear. I could picture terror swelling in your iris. You would say, I cannot bear this, get me out of here.
bias with that song because it's Arlo Parks and it is called Four Violets. That's for my daughter, who recently fractured a wrist. Yay! Anyway, we're going to talk about books. So again, these are books that I read this year. So some of them are brand new or fairly new, and some of them are old, some of them are very old. So I would definitely recommend the ones that I'm mentioning here. I'm not going to really go through books that I haven't enjoyed. And again, at the end of the year, I will recap, go through what my favorite book is. So I started the year reading Prophet Song by Paul Lynch, and which is just a tremendous book, which is, I think, came out, it might have won the Booker Prize last year. And it is about, it's set in Ireland, and it's what happens when there's a civil war. He did a lot of research around Syria and the civil war in Syria, and why we look at these people in a civil war and we say, why don't you see it coming? Why don't you leave? And this is set in, you know, a fairly contemporary Ireland, and it's about, you know, what happens when civil war comes to your home, why you don't want to leave, how you still hope that things will go back to the way they were, why we hold on to that. The characters in it are offered a way out of the war zone to go overseas and look after their sister, because the people in other countries are messaging and saying, we're seeing all this horrible stuff in your country, and then, but the people in the country, the internet's been banned and it's taken down, and nothing's been getting through to them, and then eventually contact with the outside world is prohibited. So there's all of this stuff that is very common in civil wars across the world, and yet it's written from this contemporary point of view where you get this understanding of all of the horrors that brings, that go beyond just like, oh, I saw her on TV, that's horrible. But this is a very current and prescient. Yes, yeah, prescient. I mean, it happens over and over again, I'd imagine, which is the sad part. But it's so beautifully written, and it's so haunting. This one character, this one mother trying to keep her family together and trying to stop her children from going to fight. When passions arise, they're young people and they want to go and fight for the cause, but you know the dangers, but they want to do the right thing, and that's what you've taught them, and all of this stuff. So Prophet Song is by Paul Lynch is a good one. And not long after that, I read A Little Life, which is Hanya Yanagihara. And this is kind of, I think, it's a favorite for the old book talk and the booktube people. But it's sort of marketed, or not marketed, but on some of those sites, people sort of talking about it as like trauma porn, like, oh, this is just sad thing after sad thing after sad thing. But I don't know, I just thought it was really good. It's like a long book, it's 700 pages, but it's about these characters really intricately drawn and created, and then bad things happen to them. Basically, the point is, and this is probably what makes it sadder than all the bad things that happen to the characters, is that we sort of don't really understand actions. It sort of holds that idea up that in a lot of film and books, we get to understand everyone's actions, or we get to understand the hero's actions and justify their behavior by, let's go back and see what happened in their life, and then that explains what's happening now. Like that sort of 1+1=2 stuff, which I don't really like to do in my own life. Like, well, this happened when I was younger, and therefore this is how you act. There's a lot of connections, but there's so many influences on your life that aren't just one small event. This one small event happened, or this one large event happened, and it shades everything I do. That's fine, but it doesn't explain everything you do. Does that make sense? So these things do happen, and the trauma that we go through is real, but it doesn't just go, oh, well, that makes sense now because of what happened to you. It's about, well, and this book sort of taps into that, was I was overcoming something and then something else happened. And that's, I think, a bit more realistic, is that, or I didn't think I could get over it, and then this little thing happened. And I didn't help me get over it completely, but it was made me different somehow. And we change and we're shaped by our lives and we shape our lives. All of that stuff is a bit more nuanced in this book than just this bad thing happened and then it was traumatic and then I got over it and then something else happened. It just seems to be like we are never going to understand each other completely. We're really desperate to understand each other, but we just can't. But then I wanted to read something happy. So again, I read a lot of Agatha Christie. That's what I do as a palate cleanser, which was Five Little Piggies. That was pretty good. I have read also Franny and Zooey. Is that how you pronounce it? Zooey? Which is J.D. Salinger. I've got Catcher in the Rye somewhere here. I think I might have only read it once. I enjoyed it, but it never really grabbed me. But this book was probably, like the hipster in me wants to say, oh, this is better. I like this better than Catcher in the Rye. But I don't know. It's certainly more, the point of view is more adult than sort of Holden Caulfield's perspective. But when I read it, the main reason I wanted to talk about was it's clearly influencing, like, Infinite Jest and the Royal Tenenbaums, things like that, which I like both of those things. But clearly when I was reading it, I was like, oh my God, this is just, again, being copied. These sort of middle, upper class New York types who are struggling with their issues of connecting with their family members who live in very nice places, but also just have a generation gap they can't quite fill. I really enjoyed, sort of in two parts, but I really enjoyed the first section where Franny goes on a date with a terrible English major student. Yeah, those English major students. Guess what? He doesn't listen to anything she says and he just talks about how clever he is. It's a very strange book though. Like there's 100 pages like this discussion with Franny and Zooey about like what's the correct way to worship Jesus. Like there's basically all dialogue between the two of them. It's a long scene of them talking about what makes them a good person and what's the point? You know, what's the point of being a good person? Does it matter? Is it okay? Bad things happening. That old, you know, it's a very old discussion. If bad things happen, then what's the point? I just found it pretty interesting. And another older book I read was, which I hadn't read and I felt ashamed when I read it, which is A Room of One's Own by Virginia Woolf. And I love Virginia Woolf to The Lighthouse and Mrs. Dalloway in particular, like some of my favorite books ever. And I think when I read it, yes, I felt ashamed for not reading it. And I one of those books where I studied modernism at university and I don't understand why we didn't read this as a exploration of the time. We were doing context and things like this. We were too busy reading the poetry of what's his face? H.D.? I don't even know who that is. D.H. Lawrence. A lot of D.H. Lawrence poetry I had to read. Didn't like any of that. Don't really like D.H. Lawrence. Had to read a lot of man poetry, usually about orgasms and, you know, what does this represent? We don't know. Oh, it's sexual. Of course it is. All that stuff. No thank you. Which, you know, if I probably read it now, I'd be like, well, it's pretty obvious. But anyway, A Room of One's Own is not about that. I think I wrote here too that it's... I complain that I should have studied it, but it was probably on suggested readings that I just never did, second year uni or first year uni. No, thank you. But it's a really good discussion of why there aren't women authors and why women don't write. You know, she makes points that are fairly modern. Like this is a 100-year-old book and she's saying men can write whatever they want about women, but when women write about men, the men get angry and dismissive that you are being inaccurate and come back at you with all of these things about how dare you. And they can write whatever they want about the women in their stories. She just writes about like the finances, basically, and the lack of independence, financial independence of women actually stops them from pursuing art, not just writing, but pursuing art. That they need, you need a room of one's own if you are going to have the luxury of being an artist. Even people, she says, even people in these rich families, the women still don't get the opportunity to create. They're always creating children, or they're always supporting their creative husbands or supporting their husbands' careers. But she always argues that, you know, fulfillment comes from your ability to express yourself. And we have denied women that because literally, like, it comes down to, we don't give them a room to themselves because we don't trust women chattering away without a man around to listen. Anyway, moving very far along into Miss Major Speaks. This is Toshio Meronek and Miss Major Griffin Gacy. Miss Major Griffin Gacy was a black trans activist, has been for over 60 years, and she is interviewed by Toshio Meronek, and it's sort of an interview, but it's also a like description. It's like journalism, but it also discusses a lot of interesting ideas of allyship and what's the correct way to be an ally. The way, even with things like Stonewall, the Stonewall riots, society ignored it, and now it goes, oh, that was a major development in gay rights. But Miss Major Griffin Gacy talks about, well, actually, Stonewall wasn't a gay hangout. It was sort of like a place where any sort of fringe member of society could go. So trans people, it was a place for them to be. People, even she was saying, even mixed race people, this is the 60s, could go there. So she, or they, maybe it's they, sorry, are talking about how even something like Stonewall is just broken and simplified. We simplify people's identity, we simplify their sexuality, and then Stonewall riots, and we go, oh, that was about being gay, and fighting up the police, attacking them because they were gay. And it wasn't just that. And that led to the gay rights movement, but it led to so many other movements. Fascinating book, fascinating person. And then I read a book, Australian book called Limber Lost, by Robbie Arnott. A very small world set in Tasmania that sort of highlights those little moments in our life that sort of become long, they become big scars. So that's not like a huge tragic event, but little things, you know, witnessing the flaws of your parents, or something you worked hard on that no one else understood how hard it was. It reminded me of about this thing that isn't traumatic, but I always remembered it, which was I planted like a sunflower in the backyard and watered it. And it was a secret. I didn't tell anyone. I wanted to see if it would grow. And then it started to grow and it came out of the soil where I planted it and I was watering it. And then, like, I don't know, my dad or my mum mowed the lawn and just mowed straight over the top of it and killed it. And I just remember that, like, oh my God, that's horrible. But it's those kinds of things where a good author will turn that into something else, into like, oh, I'm now, like I said, you read it and you're like, oh, I'm six again. Someone's running over my sunflower that I planted and it'll never grow again. And so, yeah, that's Limber Lost by Robbie Arnott. I won't tell you any more about that, but there's horses in it. It's nice. I read this other book called A Month in the Country by J.L. Carr. That is I think in the 1920s it was written. This really small story about this World War One returned soldier who spends a month in this sort of abbey uncovering an old painting, like cleaning an old painting. The characters are great. And also, you know, it sort of connects when the main character is talking to a fellow, I guess, veteran of World War One. So it's only just, we've only just returned after the war. And the way they communicate is this kind of sad understanding of how horrible they feel all the time, but they know they can't really tell other people because nobody wants to actually know that. And they're British, so of course they can't express themselves completely to each other. So it's all done with sort of whispers and phrases and looks and yeah, and it has some really good pompous dialogue in there as well. And also just the characters sort of change. You get a sense of what you think the characters are, but they sort of change and justify their actions. And yeah, that's A Month in the Country. If you can find it, I think I got it on my Kindle. A Month in the Country by J.L. Carr. I read Sula by Toni Morrison. I'm pretty much convinced that Toni Morrison might be the best author that I've ever read. Maybe not my favorite, but probably the best. Just every page, great, beautiful, savage. The violence in this one is breathtaking and quick and in some cases evil, and in other cases, is it justifiable? Probably not. I read a section to my Year 7 class, which had a sort of twist at the end of it, and they loved it and freaked out, and they were just like, whoa, that's amazing. Sula is this amazing character who, I don't know, people think she's a witch. She bewitches people, and she bewitches her friends, and she bewitches men, and it's very intense in times, and I love it. Toni Morrison, one to watch out for. Our Wives Under the Sea by Julia Armfelt. Well, I've got to crack on. I've been talking forever. Our Wives Under the Sea by Julia Armfelt. Armfelt. Creepy, creepy book. Just about water, lots of water. It's sort of in two parts. It's the story of a woman whose wife has returned from a undersea sort of submersible, if you want, exploration, and she's come back changed. And the other part of the novel, it switches between perspectives of the wife in the submarine and what's going on in the submarine. I won't go into any more detail, but it really creeped me out and was really affecting, and described it as sticky, like it just stuck to me for a long time afterwards, and I couldn't quite work out how I felt about it or kind of what happens. Why don't I finish up with another creepy book? This is about 100 pages. It's called Such Small Hands by Andre Barber. It is unsettling as well. Children are creepy buggers. Just scary little children being weird, and just unsettling. Another really unsettling book. It's under 100 pages. And when you read it and then go, well, that was weird, then look it up and go, oh, it's based on a true story. Whew, how about that? That's not great. But yeah, that's Such Small Hands by Andre Barber. Just a great book. There was one more I wanted to read. It's called The Details. It's by Ia Genberg. It's a Swedish book originally, and it's been translated, and apparently translated in close quarters. So the author and translator sat down together and basically did page by page. The author can speak fairly good English, of course, and so was worked really hard at conveying the same tone and the same message, but that's why the book is good. But it's also this really cool book about character and memory, and it's like, I'm not sure if it's just a memoir. It reads like a memoir, but apparently it's just sort of a memoir, and so it's a person talking about these encounters they've had in their life and with different people that have sort of shaped them. And I really enjoyed it because there's a lot of times where you're like, oh, sometimes you're in moments and you're like, this section of my life is going to shape me. You know, you've heard me talk a lot about when I moved out of home and I was living in Newcastle at university. We knew at the time, like, oh, yes, this is a very very important part of our lives, and this is shaping my friendships and who I am and what I enjoy and that kind of thing. But a lot of times we realize looking back, like, oh, this was like, oh, I lived there. Or I knew this person for 6 months and they made a big impact on me that I haven't really considered and I didn't notice at the time, but I'm always thinking back to what they said or what they did. And it's a really cool book like that. That's why it's called The Details. And it's got some sections in there that I think have been already stolen by other people and maybe put into movies, but I won't go into that too much detail. But you know, sometimes relationships are intense. They don't have to be romantic, but you're just like, whoa, you know, especially when you travel and you're like, oh, I spent 2 weeks with them and whew, we told each other everything and we saw each other every minute of every day for 2 weeks, and then they're gone. And that's what this book's about. So they're my movies, they're my books, and stay tuned because Justine's going to join me to talk about a movie called Dumplings. And for some of you, maybe most of you, you could probably check out now because it's pretty gross.
I could eat that girl for lunch as she dances on my tongue.
All right, test. Working? Yes. All right, as promised, it's the end of the episode. I've got my lovely wife here. Hi, Justine.
Hi.
And what are we going to talk about?
What are we here to talk about?
Yes.
I don't know.
I wanted to talk about the movie that we watched last week, week before.
Mm-hmm.
2004's Chinese Hong Kong production of Dumplings.
Yes, Fruit Chan.
Fruit Chan is the director.
Yeah.
We heard about it from friends of ours.
Yeah, friends of ours mentioned it.
They said, dinner. We saw a movie at a film festival called Dumplings. And we said, oh, okay. By the way, if you're a bit squeamish, maybe don't listen. And if you don't like spoilers, maybe don't listen. but most of you, as I said, are probably never going to watch this movie, especially if you hear what it's about. Anyway, they mentioned like, oh, yeah, we saw this movie, Dumplings.
Well, we were talking about horror movies and stuff. I'll say, oh, yeah, I love horror. My favorite one is Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah.
And we were talking about horrors, and they brought that one up. I'm like, I've never heard of it.
Never heard of it. And I looked it up, and it was like a woman makes dumplings that propose to give the power of eternal youth, or
the premise of it was sort of similar to Death Becomes Her.
Yeah, oh, that's right. We might have talked about it.
Search for eternal,
yeah,
youth and beauty.
So it's a movie about like vanity and especially women's place in society and how important it is to keep looking
remain
young,
youthful.
Yeah. The men not so much, but for the women, it's part of who you are.
Yeah.
So it really focuses on the main character who makes the dumplings, and really one woman who's like a faded TV star, who demands that she provide her with these dumplings once it starts working.
Well, she's losing her youthful appearance. So she's,
yes.
Her husband has taken off with a younger woman, and she's not as famous as she's not getting the movie parts, the TV roles. So she's feeling very down on herself. So she's needing a quick fix in getting back her husband's affections.
Yeah. And the woman who makes the dumplings, it's sort of hinted, people keep asking her, like, how old is she? And she sort of answers with, like, how old do you think I am?
Mm.
But not really answering it. And I don't know, how much do we want to give away? Do we want to just give all of it away? Like, what's in the dumplings, Justine?
I don't think we can. I can't. They have to see it for themselves.
Well, that's why I said, if you really want to watch it, go and watch Dumplings and don't listen to this bit. Come back and listen to it if you want.
Yeah, this could just be just go and see it, but not...
This is the end of the episode, so you can just turn it off.
Yeah,
there's go a spoiler alert.
Okay, if you are... Well, see, the thing is, if you're not too put off by, you know, like if you've got a high tolerance for gore and horror, then watch it.
Yeah.
And if you don't, then don't. But if you don't, you shouldn't be listening to this either. So,
because we'll get into it and then you'll be like, oh my God.
Yeah, so I don't want to spoil it for those people who do want to watch it.
Uh-huh.
And the people who don't want to watch it.
You don't want to freak them out.
I'm going to make them vomit.
I guess so. No one's listening. That's
so I don't know who this was.
That's a very good point. Well, it doesn't matter. Yeah. So it's, you said like you don't. It's...
No, because the people, I don't want to spoil it for those people who do want to subject themselves to it.
Right.
Yeah.
So suffice to say.
You will. Like it will make you feel ill.
Yeah, I felt horrible.
We both felt very sick. Matthew was convinced that he had food poisoning coming on from the.
Yeah, we
he was convinced
I made,
he had a bad prawn.
I made a beautiful prawn linguine, fresh prawn, tomato linguine for dinner. Beautiful, and then I sat there watching a movie, going, "This movie making me feel sick, or have I got food poisoning and I'm going to vomit?
Did we look it up beforehand? Did we know? Or did we go in blind?
Yeah, no, we knew. We knew
our friends didn't.
No,
tell
but
us.
If you look it up as well, that's the problem. We look it up? Yeah, I looked it up what it was. Okay. And it, in a lot of places, it tells you.
Oh, no. I think she did. They did tell us. No, they did tell us.
Oh.
Yeah, she said, well, yeah, there was talk of.
Explained what's in the.
What's in them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we did know.
But I wish we didn't. That was one part.
I wish we didn't. That's right. That's why I don't want to spoil it. So,
yeah.
No, they did say, they did tell us. So it's from 2004. Like, they, you know, didn't think we'd immediately go and watch it. So they were just telling us, oh, this movie and this
they
happens.
Don't know us.
And we're like, oh, my God. So, yeah, we did have warning. But even with that warning, it was difficult, very difficult to watch. I mean, there were a few scenes that I couldn't watch.
Yeah.
And it's funny because historically Matthew does not have an interest in these.
Yeah, but it's not. But it's not.
But hey, eyes wide, glued to the screen the whole time. Didn't look away. I was looking at him most of the time.
But it's all implied, though.
Yes, that's the thing. Like, this was so clever about it. There's nothing too much.
I don't like body horror. I don't like.
You're actually not seeing anything gory.
No.
In the worst scenes that I couldn't look at, the kids could have come out and you wouldn't really know what it was.
No. Like, so again, it's all implied. They set up exactly what's happening, and then your brain does the rest.
Once you know, then seriously, just this lovely little Asian lady eating dumplings slowly, like just a plate of dumplings. Just
the thought of it is not
the
curdling.
Sound.
Yeah, sound
the
design
crunch. It's the crunch.
Yeah,
I will never
prawn hao gao.
Never eat
happening.
Prawn hao gao again, and. I will never forget that sound.
Yeah.
But
it also, like, it's a really interesting movie, right? It's a really interesting movie that goes into, I guess, like, it's quite political in its description of, like, almost like discussing underclass as well.
Yeah.
And
it's, you know, the one-child policy.
Yeah, it sort of covers a
China
whole lot of things. Like I said, it's talking about the Chinese government.
You know, obviously, with the one-child policy, there's a lot of unwanted pregnancies that have to be dealt with.
Yeah, very subtle, Justine. Anyone putting two and two together out there? Oh, dear. Yes, but it goes into a whole lot of different areas of like, Chinese policy, and they actually discuss it.
Yes.
And then it just has probably, what, three just rampant sex scenes? Just...
No, the sex scenes, you don't actually see anything.
No.
Not nary a nipple.
Nary. That's on the poster?
Yeah, you might see a bottom.
Yeah, really? You see bottoms.
Maybe a bottom, but yeah, nothing graphic. Again, it's all just like the way it's shot and the sounds that are coming out.
Poor phrasing,
it's the soundtrack and the... Like, the way it's shot, it's very clever. Like, you're not actually seeing anything too graphic.
No.
At all. But I've never been so squeamish in a movie in my life.
And it's certainly a movie that I'm not watching that again.
No, I don't want to either. And I normally love that
kind
of stuff. But it's a lot. But very clever because, you're not actually, like, you know, I think that the worst scene for me, there's two really bad ones, but the worst one was... where a medical procedure was happening to a young lady who found herself in.
Just stop talking. Medical procedures are bad. It's as simple as that. But again, you don't see anything.
But but you don't see anything.
Yeah.
Like, you just see the, like,
it's weird. You see a lot. You see a lot, but you don't see anything. Does that make...
It's the anticipation. It's the anticipation because he has these long scenes, like the scenes with her eating the dumplings. Like, you imagine an unbroken scene of someone sitting there eating dumplings. Probably is pretty unsettling in itself.
Yeah.
The crunch.
You know nothing of the crunch, Justine. Have a quick little day trip around the crunch.
And the close-ups of her mouth.
Yeah.
Unsettling...
Like again,
a long shot.
Our children could have walked out to watch to see
us squirming
around. A 3-minute scene of a woman eating dumplings.
Yeah,
and it's been so weirded out by our response to this woman eating dumplings. Yeah, it is a wild movie and just oh God, I felt ill. And now I feel ill even thinking about it now.
Yeah. It's a lot. I mean,
yeah.
Not one for the faint-hearted.
No, so let us know if after what we've talked about made you rush out and find dumplings from 2004. We found it on YouTube, didn't we? It was like $1.20 or something.
Definitely worth it.
For 2 nights. I mean,
really well shot.
Yeah.
Beautifully shot.
Yeah.
The soundtrack was really well done. Cinematography was beautiful.
Yeah.
It just, the concept of it was just terrific.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love movies that manage to get that response without actually showing all that much. It's just hinting at when you know what's happening. But it would have been, I think, a different experience having if we didn't know what it was about.
Yeah, and just I agree. In.
Although it gets into it pretty damn
quickly. It does get into it quickly, but it would have been nice for the first few minutes to be like, huh, not really sure what's going on there. Oh, now we are. Oh, how about this? Okay. All right. Well, that all finishes off. The look on her face, you're reliving it, aren't you?
Yes.
Yes, me too. All right. Well, that is all. Why don't we end the episode with, why don't I find a scene, just the sounds of someone eating dumplings.
Crunch.
That's it.